In tech we trust. Sure about.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 72 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. I'm here today with Lauren.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing cool.
How many beers in are you, Lauren?
Only three at this point. But
by the time we're done, who knows?
That's right.
How many that will grow to? And with Rickatron.
Hey, Rickatron is not traveling this week.
Not traveling this week. What's with that?
Well, actually, I was going to go to Austin, and we'll get to that in a bit. But I just, man, I had to draw a line. I have too many things taking me too many places. This is my week of the month, and I'm not traveling. So good luck to have me on another episode the rest of the month. But I just, you know, I have to draw a line. I just couldn't take it.
So the week of Valentine's Day, you'll be traveling somewhere, but this week?
Cisco Live with Lauren and Gabe. Yes, I'm in shame, ducking my head as I am looking at the most expensive option of flowers to have delivered in my absence. Yes.
Come on, Rick. I'm bringing my fiance with me.
Amy Love, just, you know, she works too, and it's like so many very limited amounts of time that she can go. And honestly, Berlin in the winter didn't do it for her, I'll just be honest. So that's what's up.
Fair.
And we don't have we're missing Nigel and Gabe.
Boom.
And we know where Nigel is. Nigel's in Austin, and he's at the is today the Tech Field Day, or is today the Tech Unplugged?
Well, Tech Unplugged was Tuesday, and this is the second and I believe final day of Tech Field Day. And honestly, it was a great arrangement when they put them both together. My colleague was down there, got a little video interview with Nigel, and I'll say it on the air. Nigel, you need a haircut, mate. Man, whoa.
But, I disagree.
Man, I'm just – or maybe keep it a little bit better. I don't know.
He said he hasn't run a comb through it since his wedding day.
That's what I'm talking about.
So he's had it cut, but he doesn't comb it.
I'm telling you,
that's
he's
an interesting
more
approach.
Like,
I mean,
Matthew McConaughey every day.
Oh man, we should do some steering wheel cams with that guy.
All right.
I've been working on a new steering wheel cam technique, a new thing. It just involves a big rubber band and a GoPro.
You should do that on an airplane. Just like strap it to the seat in front of you. Start doing, you know, airplane cam. I'm sure your passengers.
You do the whole Matthew McConaughey thing. You know, we're sitting on an airplane. It's like, I just fly 737s jet.
The only way I fly is 30,000 feet in the air.
Yeah. Speaking of flying this way, right? Nigel was kind of carping or complaining about travel, right? Yeah, I think he was saying that he doesn't know how many more of these he wants to do because he doesn't like traveling. I mean, what does he know about travel? I'm asking you, Rick, especially.
Well, you know, Gabe, myself, and Lauren, you know, in our roles, and you too, Mark. I think you actually have a good arrangement of you know, the balance of travel. We travel a lot for work. I mean, when I look at my skills that what I have in the workplace, I am best suited going into different situations, talking to people, events, press analysts, whatever that I do, a lot of different things. And that just takes me places. That's my skill. On the flip side of that, I totally get what Nigel is saying. I'll be honest with you. I do not like or do not look forward to spending 16, 20 hours, whatever it is, to go from here to there. You know, the three of us, Gabe, Lauren, and I will be in Berlin in 2 weeks. I don't look forward to the journey. I'll be honest, I don't. When I'm there and I'm in my element, love it. That's pure Rickatron, right? But it's not fun. I mean, my company doesn't give me business class, so, you know, I don't have those little beds, right? So it's not great. Even domestically, I went to Portland last week. I got lucky, got a domestic upgrade on most of that route, but on, you know, the one of the long stretches on the way back, man, it was just not comfortable. For sure, I'm a hefty one, but I feel where Nigel's coming from. You know, you're away from your family, which I, you know, got two kids. It's a tough balance, right? But, you know, I look at my skills, how do I best do that in the workplace, and it takes me places, but there's a consequence of time in the air, nights in a hotel. I totally get what he's saying, but unless you've done the road warrior thing, nobody would understand that, you know, I love going places and working with different people, but I hate being gone, right? So it's a weird dichotomy that nobody understands unless they've done it.
So what do you do when you go on the road? You check out all kinds of food and restaurants, and you know, you post interesting pictures of things that you're eating in places. I mean, do you have other things that you look for when you go to like try to make it more amenable?
That's the one thing you can tweak, right? You know, take in the food and the, you know, Portland is a great craft beer city, right?
So, ooh, yeah.
You know, I did good there within reason, of course. But it's one of those things that's nice. And I love to cook at home. So you know what I do? I take a taste I find somewhere. I come home and get all crazy with the stuff, you know? I remember when I went to Singapore in 2015, I came home and I'm making stuff that I tried there. You know, I can't even remember the name. I took a picture because I would have forgot. But, you know, Malaysian
sea urchin and stuff, I think. You know.
Yeah, or Malaysian curry. I'm never going to find that easy in Ohio, but I'll try it easily in these, you know, other places, right? So, yeah, that's the good part. And meeting new people, that's a good part. You know, seeing something different, that's a good thing, right? I am a person that needs variety. Not everybody can handle that. I'll be straight up honest with you. I know some people that would get upset if they had to, you know, move a cube or go to another floor in the building for a meeting, right? It's just depending on the personality. For me, it works, and I get the good food.
You know what? I don't like attending meetings. I'm just saying.
I did have one example last year where I did what I would call tourist stuff. I was in New Zealand, and then the next week I had to be in Australia. So I had the weekend.
Ooh, la la. Yeah.
And I can't go home, right? It's just too far. So I talked to my mate there locally, and I talked with Alistair in Auckland looking for some recommendations. And I took one of those day tours, a bus type of thing that took you to a bunch of places. In all my years of travel, that's literally the only touristy type of thing that I do. Because, you know, one of the things that I also do is really – throw it in there tight, like in terms of schedule. You know, I don't get in any extra time. You know, it's strictly business, right? You arrive when you need to be there and you leave when you're done, right? Turn and burn.
You need to figure out how to get some business done on the sheep farm or out on the trout stream or something.
Well, yeah, maybe. But, you know, again, that's one more night that I'm gone. And, you know, if you look at it, I don't know the number. My wife knows the number, percentage wise that I'm gone. But it's one of those things that if I can lower it a percent or a night, it makes a big difference. Or if I have to fly over overnight in a red eye to get home earlier, I'll do that, right? It's just really hard to explain, but you know, to try to balance it all, I dial it up pretty tight.
And so we don't know what Gabe's up to. Where does anybody know where he's at? Did he just like sneak off? I know we're recording a day after when we normally do because we couldn't get a quorum yesterday. So we haven't heard from Gabe. You know, it's the mystery guy today. Maybe he'll come into the show while we're recording it.
Yeah, he's got some Skype computer somewhere in the world ringing to join this podcast. He just hasn't answered yet.
Somewhere where there's so much background noise you can't hear it.
Likely.
Hey, so let's move on to some topics for this week, right? And one of the topics that I know Lauren is probably not interested in talking about is Cisco winning a patent case against Arista. And apparently it's a big deal. It looks like a federal judge or a federal agency, and the ruling could lead to a ban or a halt on imports of Arista's hardware.
Well, this could be a significantly big deal.
Since Lauren can't talk about this, Rick, I guess it's up to you and me. And unfortunately for you, it's mostly up to you because I don't know what's going on here. I haven't been following it. Have you?
Well, in our never-ending, hourless, you know, countless hours of preparation that we put into the show, I did look up a page just now that my takeaway, Mark, is that this is going to impact Arista's supply chain. This is the, you know, business to business kick in the nuts of sorts, because if you don't have a supply chain in the hardware space, this is a significant issue. So a couple of quotes, you know, legal action is always very passionate. My wife's an attorney, not on business topics, but trust me, very passionate stuff. And when money and intellectual property and stuff on the line, it's really a charged matter. You know, take the normal competitiveness that, you know, a lot of products have to the next level. This is really that next kind of tier. And it looks like it's going to hit them in the supply chain. So it's going to halt imports and stuff like that. And that's going to be interesting. It's a short answer.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I would say that we, even though we think we're in a litigious system, or litigious world, I mean, you know, and this stuff is always going on. We haven't seen big patent wars and big legal fights that much, I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this. I mean, not like it wasn't like in the 60s when everybody's coming out with IC chips and all the companies were just suing each other left and right. And it got so messy they ended up with big cross licensing agreements and that sort of thing, right? This is different.
Well, it is different, but I think that there's more legal action than you know. There's just not always legal results that aren't, okay, settlement or aren't dismissal, right? So this is a verdict. This is something that, Arista had an IPO earlier this year. As I read it, I don't know if it it definitely applies to selling these products in the United States, so it doesn't globally apply. So it could be possible that other markets could carry on. I wouldn't want to be in the black market of, you know, bringing switches across borders and stuff like that. But nonetheless, this is, you know, in terms of GDP, it's the largest market that they are not able to sell in now. So it sounds like a bad day, but, you know, honestly – I say it's kicking them in the supply chain. You know, like any element of your business, you should have some resiliency and be able to retool a supply chain. Now, sure, this is pretty much a fundamental thing, so it might be a long gap between a new product is coming out with, you know, something that's not subject to this patent battle. But I think that, you know, a supply chain gap is going to be the symptom of this, and they're going to have to resource suppliers, redesign the software in place, right, to just get around this problem. It might change the capabilities, right? It might change everything. So I don't know exactly what, you know, the switching systems, you know, meat is, but there's a lot of different switching technologies out there. So I'm pretty sure that a new secret sauce can be found at the grocery store.
You have to say, I really don't understand the switching business very well, the hierarchy of players there, the market space, who's doing what well and all that. Since Lauren's our resident expert on this space and she can't say anything about it, maybe we should move on to something else.
Yep.
But let's give Lauren a chance. Lauren, what do you think?
No comment.
Okay, so another item that we have going on is it looks like EMC and VMware are trying to do something again to remake VCE into something that can compete with Nutanix and SimpliVity. At least that's there was an article that Simon Sharwood posted. I don't think we talked about this last week, did we? No, I don't think so. And you talk about retooling, Rick. It looks like there's retooling going on there. This has been an interesting space for some time. You know, Nutanix has had this long runway to build up all of this momentum. And we've talked about their IPO and their coming IPO and the funding that they're getting and all that. We talked about Nutanix a lot. And so here now we've got EMC and VMware, and this is under the auspices. I don't see Dell showing up in this discussion at all. This looks like, you know, this looks like a plan that VMware and EMC have had in place for a long time. You know, they'll obviously do it with Dell computers, I would think. And they want to try to compete in the hyperconverged infrastructure space again. So Lauren, since you were exempt from the last topic, have you looked into this at all, what they're doing? Do you think it's got legs? Is this just talk, or do you think they're getting ready to actually do something here?
You know, I mean, here's the thing is, I think there's room in the hyperconvergence market, but we've already seen VMware enter the hyperconvergence market, and by all accounts, it's not really found in the wild. So with their Evo RHEL product, I guess, we're not really seeing that a lot. And granted, this is Gabe's kind of place. He loves the hyperconvergence, but I am dubious that this is going to be a game changer. Obviously VCE has a lot of experience with making converged storage. EMC and VCE have a lot of experience with creating hardware, and of course with VMware we get the software. They're a little behind the times, though. I mean, it's a late start for sure, several years later, behind Nutanix and SimpliVity. So it will be interesting to see if this is some sort of game changer. I'm not holding high hopes, but I don't know. Rick, what are your thoughts there?
Well, Mark's initial word was retool, and I kind of had this little grudge going on. I'm actually... But I'm thinking more repackaging. I think that this is going to be absent of a completely new technology. Dare I say, price point packaging to compete with said industry players. But let's make it very clear. I was very wary of Nutanix and SimpliVity and Maxta and Scale and whoever else is next. As a technology was emerging, as I would say, outside of the mainstream of the ecosystem. I'm looking for a better way to explain that. But it wasn't driven by key things that came from what I would call the household names. And there's good and bad to that mindset. But when we're talking about kit, that's why it matters to me. I'm all about the software. Don't get me wrong. But now I have the ecosystem, and we'll take storage spaces. We'll take vSAN. Those are ecosystem driven, right? Versus a partner technology or just an ISV or a IHV type of vendor thing. I'm not seeing any pardon upon convergence here because they're going in very different paths, and most notably with the Acropolis hypervisor. Yeah, I mean, granted, they're coming. There's going to be a new version of vSAN soon. That's in the rumor department of Simon's article. But sure, vSAN has had a lot of innovation. I actually still have good hopes for vSAN. I know a lot of people still looking at it. But the thing is, there's a certain simple value prop that comes from the Nutanix and SimpliVity model that I think is catering or capturing the pricing and packaging from these kind of what I call mainstream ecosystem, you know, larger brand realm. So I think it's exactly that.
So when you say repackaging, do you think it's a repackaging of Evo, RHEL,
or
a repackaging of something? I mean, because Dell was one of the main vendors involved in the hardware on that as well, right?
Well, if they're doing it right, I don't really think the hardware matters. I think the price and the capabilities matter. Well, the hardware always matters, but maybe it's build your own. Maybe it's via Dell. I don't know, but they don't have the announcement.
Whatever. Yeah, it'll be interesting what the go to market for this is, right? You would think it would be through Dell, that can process a lot of orders, is the ability to do the business that way, right? If they're going to try to compete with, you know, a lot of the reason why people like hyperconverged infrastructure is because it's simple to order. You buy everything in one place, right? And so how is this going to, you know, without seeing Dell in with this discussion here, it's like, okay, so do I buy it from VMware? Is it VCE? I mean, is VCE really still relevant, you know, in the world with Dell owning both these companies? I don't see how it can be. Why would it?
Absent of a fundamental new technology, I'm not really, you know, don't have much, optimism. If it's pricing and packaging, that's a market response technique. Sure, you have to promote it. I get that. But you know what? You could let me play that the other way. That could be a validation point for this model. So then you have a lot of options at this pricing and packaging point, whatever it is, but presumably competing against the other non-Federation, Evil Empire type of arrangement. you have this approach that's effectively validated due to market response from the big boys. So that's the other kind of perspective. But absent of any details, we just don't know.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to watch how it plays out. I mean, it's interesting to see. It kind of seems like, deja vu. We've seen this kind of stuff before, but maybe they'll figure it out. Something that's different, turning the page to another item, is, what's going on with Symantec and Veritas, right? It looks like there was bad news, very bad news this last week from that. Chris Meller had an article in the Register exposing things that were in the SEC filing from Symantec with the spin out of Veritas. And apparently what happened here is that in April last year, Symantec was preparing to spin out Veritas, and these kinds of things can be problematic, right? And what happened is it looks like they brought on a dedicated sales force to sell a lot of Symantec or sell a lot of Veritas's products, and that the sales force they brought in did not deliver. At least that's what the SEC filing indicates, right? There could be other things behind it, right? I mean, if the product isn't making it, if you don't have a way to process orders, you don't have a way to work, you don't have a way to market, it's very difficult. So as you take a chunk of a company and spin it out, if it doesn't have the funding, it doesn't have the people and that kind of thing, it can be problematic. And it looks like that is what's happening to Veritas. I'll just throw this out there as a jump ball. Have either of you, Lauren or Rick, have you looked into what Chris's article and what it says?
I've skimmed through, and I won't quite take the no comment route, but just I'll say to the listeners, in my professional role, I compete with these two, and it's an interesting situation. I'll say that, but honestly, business changes at the fundamental level, diverging acquisitions, those types of things, there's going to be check engine lights along the way, and Meller has a lot of information there, so I'm not going to beat on any bad situation, especially, like I said, because it's part of my role in an evangelist in a competitive standpoint. But yeah, it doesn't look good. Short answer.
Yeah, well, I'll just finish what I was saying here. It really looks like a lot of the execution issues here for Veritas are sales oriented. People were brought in, they're being fired, they're bringing other people in now, right? Right. Which, and this stuff happens from time to time. And I mean, being in different startups and different companies, the way sales management works and, who grows the company from such and such size to some other place, who can take a company from being $100 million company to $1 billion company? Who can take a company from a $10 million company to $100 million company? Right. These are the kinds of these are different types of skills and different types of management approaches. Right. I think the problem that you've got here is when you ask the question, who can take a company that's being spun out of a large company and create an effective direct sales force when it's been done by another company for a long time? Different situation entirely. And I can only imagine the politics and the budget things being very problematic. So it might be easier and it might not. I certainly hope that Veritas has a better ending than being spun out of Symantec into some sort of collapsing black hole. I've liked that company I've liked that company and its technology for a long time. Yeah, it's kind of a shadow of its former self from where it was back in the 90s in the double aughts. That was a juggernaut software company. A number of things happened to it. Gary Bloom probably being the worst one, which ended up resulting in them being acquired by Symantec in the first place. And now the spin out, and it looks like the spin out has been fumbled so far. But I hope they do get it together, because it's a like I say, it's a company that I've liked for a long time.
Well, there's a big customer base, right? So it's one of those things that can actually survive a pretty big bump, right? So I'm trying to be optimistic here. I am watching it, I'll admit that. But this is one of those things that back-end changes, everything from the ERP to the Salesforce, those are hard things to do. And the expectations are really high to turn ships like this quick. And granted, totally different approach, but remember what we were talking about in the summer? When Chambers is going to retire, I think that the way Cisco handled that, granted much, much bigger, but much, much smoother, no divestiture of sorts, but a big time change at the helm, which is kind of in a way what's going on. I think it was very clear how they said, this is our leadership. This is how many years they have at Cisco. This is why it's going to be a smooth transition. Just, you know, look at the way some of these things happen and the way different companies do it. And you can see that the actions indicate predictively some of the results, kind of an observation I have.
Well, I think the issue, at least the way that Veritas and Symantec are trying to state it, is that it's a sales execution problem. It's not anything else. You know, it doesn't, but, you know, remains to be seen. One interesting note here, you know, the personal interest to me is that David Scott, who I used to work for at 3PAR and HP, he's on the board there apparently. It says the board is being led by Bill Krause, former president and CEO of 3Com, and David Scott from 3PAR. So it'll be interesting to see if those guys are able to bring some relief to what's going on there. They've got a lot of work to do. You know, you think these guys retired, they've got it made. You know, they go sit on a board somewhere, and you know, they basically show up for meetings every 3 months. You know, and bring in, rake in their stock. This is a lot harder than that. This is a board position that's going to require a lot of thought and to provide a lot of leadership. So good luck to those guys.
I'm just curious. Do you guys, in your recollection, has there been a spin out of kind of a large company? Let's say, I mean, something that's
like a good divestiture example,
right? That a successful split, not
you
just
know
a
what?
Spin out
HP,
from you
HP
know,
Enterprise and HP might be the best right now example.
Yeah,
I think it seems to me they're doing fine. Let's see what else. Well, before that, HP's had some other ones. Like Agilent was pretty good when Agilent came out of HP. You know, it wasn't a household. It's not a consumer product in any way, but I think that company did fairly well. What else? Well, maybe we'll come back to that. Maybe we'll think about that. What have successful large scale spin outs? What have some of them been? But let's go on to something else. Another big company. And, you know, we'll go from one of my favorite guys, David Scott, to one of my least favorite guys, Mark Hurd.
So this
I never like anything Mark Hurd says anymore. Right. So Rick, you found something.
Most authoritative news source for the podcast. This is the first time that an Instagram picture has made the cut here.
Woot.
So yeah. You know, I love Instagram, guys. You know, I'm on it. I love following corporate brands, especially those in technology that, you know, I use every day. It's very interesting to see that kind of portal to them. Anyways, Oracle on their Instagram post quoted put a picture up of CEO Mark Hurd and said, quote, Oracle CEO Mark Hurd predicts that 100% of dev test, presumably dev test IT, will be in the cloud within 10 years. Now, he only got 322 likes on this picture, but 100% of dev test. And then on top of that, Hurd goes on to say, and this is his quote from the Instagram picture, says, moving development and testing to the cloud could be $150 billion of opportunity to our customers. I was initially like, 100%? Really? First of all, 10 years, okay, a lot's going to change in 10 years. But if I look back 10 years, not that much changed. People are still buying stuff. People are just doing different apps. I get that. But if I look forward 10 years, I don't know if I buy this 100%.
Are they trying to, you know, going back to our conversations a few months ago, are they trying to create a self-fulfilling prophecy of Oracle being the number one cloud provider?
Well, if they need 10 years to get it right, something else is going to happen between now and then.
Nope. Sorry about that, guys.
Did Gabe join?
No.
Maybe he did. Oh, he did join.
Wait a minute. What?
We can believe it.
Oh, my gosh.
Where my ears were burning.
Oh, we might have to backtrack just a little. We might have to backtrack just a little. But
oh,
that's
no,
okay.
No, not for me.
Well,
yeah, no, we actually
like, yeah, Gabriel guy, he's unreliable. He never shows up for the damn call.
No. You show up a lot, but I'm going to give you like a couple minutes, and then I'm just going to hit you up to like do a 2-minute rant on something, and then cut you off. We were just ranting on Mark Hurd's like amazingly bad Instagram thing.
Oh, okay, Gabe. You know, Lauren's right. This self-fulfilling prophecy that Oracle made. Have around cloud services What's your opinion on it, given that you know nothing about it? Rant now.
Oracle has cloud services? I mean, that'd be my big question. No, I mean, let's talk about this, right? So I'm going to go in here completely blind. I've not read the article. I don't know what they're talking about. I'm completely making this up as I go, right? Oracle and cloud, yeah, right? Let's go after another thing. I mean, unless they can license the entire cloud by the cores that are out there in terms of, like, you know, thousands and thousands of servers and systems that aren't even your own. I mean, you know, how many islands does the guy need to buy? But I mean, the reality is they've tried to go out and buy talent, i.e., you know, OpenStack talent. Like, they picked up all the guys from Nebula for dirt cheap. They've made these kind of overtures towards, like, hey, we're going to get in the cloud game and whatnot. And I'm like, really? I just don't think it's going to fly, and I don't think it's going to work. And I think they should kind of just stick to, you know, what they do well, which is database stuff. And, you know, every other little endeavor they've kind of gone off into hasn't really done so well. You know, and really, I don't think anybody goes to Oracle for those types of services.
Well, fair assessment, you know, considering you have no flipping clue what we talked about just before. But,
yeah, I heard something about Instagram.
It all started with the pick, man. But here's
they're going to buy him. Oracle's going to buy Instagram.
Oh, that's right. Well,
that'll do, right? So, and then they'll find a way to charge you for every picture you put on the Instagram.
I'm just
apparently
a little
for $150 billion. Yeah.
Well, so
it
here's...
It is funny that Mark hurts on Instagram. It does kill me.
But anyways.
There we go.
So last two press releases from Oracle do have the word cloud in there, which is a good sign of sorts. But, you know, I went to cloud.oracle.com, and I was actually surprised at all the different services they have. Now, I don't know anybody using them, but everything from development to managing content to integration services and what's this thing? Data management. I guess they have an interest in that. Platform as a service, infrastructure as a service. They got a lot of stuff. So the self-fulfilling prophecy that you mentioned, Lauren, that's got to be the goal, the end state there. You know, they forecast it to be a $150 billion, you know, market of sorts. They didn't say over a lifetime or that they're going to lose $150 billion on the experiment or annual revenue. He didn't really qualify that in the quote. But, you know.
No, let's say this part of the quote, though, Rick, because I think it's hilarious, right? It could be $150 billion of opportunity for our customers.
Yeah, what does that mean? Does that mean
they're trying to say that if i.e. Oracle customers try to work with Oracle and implement their version of hybrid cloud or cloud services internally, the cost savings will equate to $150 billion of something. I mean, maybe is it cost savings because they no longer have to buy at $45,000 per core? Or per socket,
or does it mean that they're going to like just extract that money from their customers?
Oh yeah,
it could be. You know, it's not. Here's the deal: I'm part curious, part not wanting to even look at it, but part knowing that in the end they always make money. And you know, I don't know if you guys have ever been invited as bloggers and such to like a webcast from Oracle. I got invited once. Or it was a briefing, and it was 6 hours WebEx. I'm like, six hours? You sure?
Yeah.
Is that enough? But it's just one of those things that I'm watching what they're doing, and, you know, he had a blog post, Forbes. Oh, no, this is something at Forbes, but he had this observation for the cloud, and, you know, he's looking lofty revenue targets he doesn't predict any cannibalization. Interesting. Live or die, vertical integration, and who is the 800-pound gorilla? And he actually has a video. I guess I should have watched that to prepare for this. But I'm going to watch this. Maybe next week I'll be a little bit more equipped. But, you know, I will go so far, as much as I like to critique, but Oracle might be the dark horse in the cloud space. They have the money and the, you know, that enterprise mind share to do it. They really do.
There's a vaporware page, and you know, are there any customer testimonials? Are there big highlights? Is there a, you know, this ROI calculator that goes up there and says, you know, use an Oracle cloud, blah 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 blah. I mean, is there all the content collateral around a push like that? I mean, frankly, I talk to a lot of cloud companies and you know, service providers and people that are building solutions and offering X as a service and whatnot. And I've never heard Oracle Cloud ever come up. Like, the only time I've heard Oracle come up is A, is like, damn, we have to pay an Oracle license. And B, I did run into one telecommunications company that was using Oracle for email.
They have email?
Well, yeah, they have this weird program. It was like, oof, you know, 5 million subscribers. I mean, it was actually pretty
okay,
robust.
Look, we're not going there. We're just not going there. Yeah.
But the thing is like, I mean, you look, I mean, a huge company, highly profitable, more money than they could possibly know what to do with. If they wanted to get into that space and compete, I think they definitely could. The problem is like, you know, how are you going to differentiate yourself from Amazon or Microsoft or Google in the public space? And then how are you going to go compete against the people that have been doing this for the last decade, for the most part, who also tend to be your own customers to a certain extent? You know, you're going to kind of compete against yourself in this space. And I just don't know if it's something that, you know, I would necessarily go towards, even though I think they have the technological and engineering talent behind it, and they definitely have the sales capability to sell pretty much anything. You know, I would actually have to look at the video, or I mean, this is just all off the cuff.
We've already given Oracle way too much time already. Done. We're just done. Yeah. You know, considering everything that we say. No. We're done. That's it. We're done.
Stick a fork in it.
We're going to stick a fork in this discussion because we all agree that it's not worth talking about. So why are we? What is worth talking about, what you went around earlier for, Gabe, was this whole thing about what EMC and VMware are doing. And we know how much you like to get on the rant about anything HCI. So if you've looked at this at all, you know, what's going on there. You know, we talked about – my point earlier is Dell involved in this thing? You know,
how is Dell involved in this? Because you know what, at Tech Field Day just yesterday in Tech Unplugged, they had people from Nutanix out there pitching the Nutanix the FX series or whatever the heck it's called, right? So how does that dovetail into the EMC Federation strategy around hyperconverged infrastructure? Let's put this out there right now: Evo fail. Right, we're talking did not even begin to address, you know, what the two predominant, you know, leaders in the space, which were, you know, obviously Nutanix being the big dog and hyperconverged.
I'm just going to say this. It's Lauren actually covered the whole Evo fail thing earlier, although she didn't call it Evo fail.
No, Rick was saying that it's a repackaging, and I said, is it a repackaging of Evo RHEL?
It's vSAN. I mean, Evo RHEL was vSAN ready nodes with an installer that basically, you know, if anything, you blew on it hard, it fell over. And then vSpecs Blue, which was equally worse, which I heard that they sold one of, and I know somebody from EMC will probably come by and say, oh, we sold thousands of them. That entire foray into hyperconverged was like rushed, did not understand the space, didn't comprehend the value that hyperconverged was actually bringing to the table. It was a packaging exercise to sell more vSAN ready nodes, essentially what it was. And, you know, they just didn't even think about it. It was underperformance. It was badly spec'd. It just didn't bring a whole lot of value or utility outside of what some of them could have built themselves. VCE is going to, you know, they're going to come to the table. They're going to bring a lot of effort. They're going to go in and seed the hell out of their customer base and call that sales. And they're going to do all the things that they've done with every other product launch that they've done before and call it a great success. And the reality is like, I don't know if I don't work in the hyperconverged space so much anymore, but it's like, I still keep my ear out for it. And I'm just like, I don't. You know, I mean, I love Chad writes the best stuff, right? I love reading all the forward vision things. And I understand the area and direction they're going and some of the packaging and how they're looking to address this and how they're looking to push the appliance-based model versus the rack scale-based model and what that customer looks like. They do a lot of that really well in terms of kind of like thought leadership in how it would resonate with, you know, your traditional stodgy enterprise customer base. Those two solutions, they have a lot of traction and they have a lot of, you know, value. And what you're going to see is both of those organizations try to capture other market pieces on it. They're going to make, you know, a box for big data. They'll make a box for, you know, all the different little flavors of the year or whatever it is. They'll make a container-based solution. I mean, you're going to see all of that stuff come out. I'm going to almost guarantee within the next 24 months. And it's going to play well with that, know, the Gartner crowd that is really risk averse, and, you know, they just want stuff that's going to work, and they, you know, they like the concept of five nines, and, you know, that's who they've always bought from. And then you're going to have this giant bar channel ecosystem that's going to push it real hard and hard and hard.
I'm going to say something else too, though, right? You could read Chad's blog, or you could read Kendrick Coleman's blog, and then you'll get a lot more out of Kendrick's blog, I think, right?
Oh, no, Kendrick's smart.
Kendrick is working for EMC on container stuff, and he had a great post today. You should probably find it. And he was talking about the things that EMC was doing to implement the new changes in the Docker, what, 1.1.1.0 or something like that. And it's a good post. So if you're developing and you're interested in how EMC storage will work with Docker, you should go read Kendrick's blog. It's really terrific. But I want to change the topic actually over to Docker a little bit. And I'm going to do this for Nigel because he couldn't be here, and he was furiously typing away things that he thought we need to talk about. I'm just going to read verbatim what he wrote in the show notes, and then we'll take the discussion there. He says, you need to mention Docker's acquisition of unikernel systems as a sign of them keeping an eye on the future and the next thing, and potentially move away from being another container company and more to being a build, ship, run tooling company, no matter whether it's containers or unikernels or whatever, right? Interesting thing for Nigel. And so, you know, we said, hey, Nigel, what's a unikernel? It's like, oh, I could just imagine him sitting there in Austin shaking his head at the three of us.
They make chicken, right?
Yeah.
It's Norm MacDonald nowadays.
Yeah. So is that who's being Colonel Sanders?
That's who
now?
The colonel is. Yeah, it's Colonel
is Norm
Sanders.
MacDonald? Norm MacDonald. Oh, okay.
He's awesome at it, too. He's the unikernel.
So to answer the question for anybody that wants to know that's listening, because Nigel is into this stuff, right? He says with unikernels, you build an app and the OS that goes with the app. So you put these things together, but you only include the OS components that are absolutely necessary. So the unikernel environment, they're smaller, faster, and more secure than containers because you don't have code hanging out there that's running stuff that somebody can hack into because it doesn't even exist. If your app doesn't need to persist data, don't compile any storage drivers into the kernel that go with your app. If it doesn't do IP4, don't include those drivers. You build the app and literally just enough OS to get your app to run. So that's Nigel's interpretation of what unikernels are. I mean, so just
Docker has to do those things, right? They have to move out of what they originally came to market as because they realized they couldn't make any money with that part. And now they're going, you know, they're expanding their... You know, I mean, look at it the same way that VMware came to market. You know, they started out doing workstation. I mean, then they branched into data center, then they branched into networking, you know, and then storage and all these other pieces. You have to build that more encompassing ecosystem and not be that kind of one-trick pony. And you also have to start monetizing and building more value around what you're doing, especially in a burgeoning technical space. And when you're the market leader, you have to continue to build to maintain your market leadership, or you're going to get eclipsed. And I think
the problem though is that this is an ecosystem that has grown so quickly. Are there enough places for Docker to do this with, right? If this is an admission that Docker can't make money, knowing that the whole ecosystem has been created, I mean, can they really find niches where they can?
It's too early. But you're right. To the point where it's like it's changing too fast, or things are being too many people have rushed into this space too quickly with too many competing disparate interests. And the reality is they're all chasing like 3% of the people who are really going to do this and pay money for it while everybody else is playing around. And that space where containers and you know what, there's a great article that, you know, there's a couple people that are really kind of like, oh my God, unikernels, are you crazy? And I cannot remember the article, who wrote the article and where they came from. There are a couple people out there that are going, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of, right? You're going to get contrarians for anything, but, you know, this is not like a universally accepted.
Is it John Twiggle?
No, it was somebody else who actually, you know, lays out the case for it. And it's not even that there's so many ecosystem players in the unikernel space. It's just in the container space. It's not even so much container space. It's the management, implementation, and turning and making container utilization easy and turnkey for the enterprise who would like to go that route. And OpenStack faces the same challenge, right? It's still not quite mature enough. It's still not quite production ready, except for those companies who understand and have kind of always done work like this and have applications or design applications that can follow and leverage these things. But those are such a small space right now that I can understand why it's hard to make money, because everybody else, when you look at the polls, like Kubernetes did a poll on, like kind of the state of the Kubernetes thing. It's like, 57% of the people responded said, yeah, I use it on laptop. You're not making money if 50% of your base is using it on a laptop, right? And I would hazard a guess that in the Docker ecosystem, granted, it's developers developing things and leveraging it through there. But, you look at some of the numbers around people that are using it in production, and you look at how many people responding in these polls. You pull 1,200 people and 14% or 17% are saying, yeah, we use this in production. That's not a large space to address when it comes to companies that need to make millions of dollars to stay viable.
Yeah, but go ahead, Lauren.
Well, I think part of the battle too is integrating it with everything, right? I mean, I know from an SDN perspective, from an ACI perspective, really, we're integrating Docker, right? But we need that. Docker needs to have that integration in order for, I think, customers to get really interested.
Yeah, but also I think people need to be able to wrap their head around, why they even go this route, why they wanted to go into containerization, what is the value and benefit to them, how do they internally monetize that and make it something that gives them a competitive advantage and worth their time and effort to go out and push this. And then keep in mind in this ecosystem, outside of the people who work in these companies that are addressing this space, it is damn hard to find talent that can implement it inside your organization. It's even harder to find, VARs or, companies out there that sell these services that have the ability to do it themselves, right? And so you're talking about, a couple thousand people on the planet that could really kind of get this up and running and go with it. And where are they going to gravitate towards? They're going to gravitate towards those organizations that have a checkbook.
Well, and are they able to pay people? Because, I mean, I know that's what I've run into. People that are really in a Docker can't pay the people enough money that know how to do it because they're already at another company doing this stuff. And, how does Docker attract that talent?
Well, and also, they have the open source ethos, and it's like, or I'm working on this part-time, or it's not my full-time job, or something I'm passionate about, but it's not, OpenStack faces the same challenge, right? Obviously everybody and their mother rushed into the OpenStack space when it started to get mature enough, and now it's dominated by, HP and Cisco and, all these other big organizations who've kind of taken over the foundation to a certain extent, because now they're seeing monetization on the horizon. They're actually starting to see people pay for these services, and it's not cheap, right? It's just, I don't think, the container space has gotten there yet. And outside of the, the handful of like super companies that have been, you want to talk containers with people from Google, I mean, they've been doing it for 10 years.
So it's always driven by apps, right? I mean, the acceptance of new technology is always driven by apps that need it, right? And it's microservices driving containers, right? The idea of that an application provides a service, and as everybody, comes in to do something, it spawns a container, or there's a new container that's launched and then later it's torn down. So that's how you get to scaling is you've got a small service of a fairly small scope, and it does this thing, and when you need to add more of it, boom, just new container, and it's done. You bring it down kind of like an accordion of containers, expanding and contracting. There's not a lot of apps written that way, right? And so it depends on new DevOps processes, if you want to call it that, or new development processes anyway, that think about what are the applications that do this, and most of them are web-based. So when you look at a company, you look at Twitter, Twitter's example, right? Oh, they do all this stuff with microservices. Great. How many companies developing applications today, are going to do it with microservices? I don't know, right? Maybe they all will in 5 years or 10 years or something. But it's hard to say. It's hard to imagine that the old style of application, not the application development necessarily, but application is going to go from being what it is to being something that's all microservices based.
So do we see Oracle going towards containers? Just to close the circle there.
It's very hard to imagine Oracle database being container-based code.
No. Well,
and obviously databases aren't really meant to be containerized. But
no, you could. I mean, there's nothing, I'll tell you right now, there's nothing to stop. Inside the container ecosystem, there are database components that run underneath that you could containerize if you wanted to, or you need to run as part of that, process, right? And that's where, things like Mongo come in and whatnot.
Right, true that. I'm just going to say this, just for the record, Nigel, You weren't here. You asked us to talk about it. You know, you got what you asked for, Nigel. Okay, hey, let's move on. We're running out of time, and there's something else I really want to get to, which is what's going on at Panassus. Right, it's another Chris Meller article from the Register talking about execs leaving Panassus. Right, and it was interesting that it came out because I wasn't even sure Panassus existed anymore. Right, so one of the guys I know, one of the guys mentioned the article I know fairly well, although I haven't talked to him in years, Andre Franklin. Loved working with Andre in the past, loved spending time with Andre. Apparently he's no longer there. He was a senior product marketing manager. He could have been, you know, product manager for all I know, a very knowledgeable storage guy. Anyway, a lot of people are moved out of Panassus. Is there any hope for this company making it? I'm going to say I don't think so, because with cloud service providers providing object storage, why does anybody need Panassus?
I forgot that they even existed.
Never heard of them.
I've actually seen one in like a customer environment. It was 2 years ago, and you know, and there's a certain market segment where they had gained traction, and you know, they were kind of like, you know, hot in, but I just don't think the plausibility to it. And when you start to see core executives all abandon ship all at once, it's definitely not a vote of confidence. And we've seen that for several companies. I mean, you know, Barracuda's pretty much in the tank, and you know, you've seen all the craziness coming from other, you know, what we would consider kind of some of these older groups, and Commvault and Veritas, and yeah,
they're done. They're done. The question is, who's going to buy them and pick up the intellectual property? Because you know there's a lot there.
Oh yeah, no, but you know, who can wait till bankruptcy court? Is there a pressing need to get it right now?
Is Oracle going to try to buy them for 10 cents?
No, but if they need them to run their Oracle cloud, they will.
Right.
Maybe they'll give them 12 cents.
This would be something in the past. Would be like EMC will pick up the IP, but EMC now, you know, under the debt cloud of the Dell deal, will EMC do it? Can they do it? Can they even think about it? Does EMC even have an M&A group anymore? Or is it already, you know, folding up? Right. So will NetApp do it? NetApp just bought, you know, SolidFire. Will NetApp buy this? It's hard to imagine them doing it, but they NetApp could certainly use object storage technology. It won't be for Parnassus's product. It'll be about the IP. Let's face it.
Yeah. I mean, and then you look at somebody like HP could pick it up, even though they've been building these relationships with, what's Leo's company? Name's escaping me right now.
That would make a lot of sense. HP doing it.
Picking up IP. I mean, there's good IP there. I mean, it was an appliance-based model. And, you know, in that respect, I mean, there's others out there, too, that are kind of addressing a space that you kind of came on the market and you're not hearing about. I mean, I don't hear anything about Cumulo anymore, do you?
I think Cumulo is probably doing okay. I don't want to take a pot shot at them. But you know that Veritas isn't going to do it.
Well, no. You guys talked about it, right? Yeah. There's just so much going on right now, and I'll tell you, the thing that's got me spooked is that the global economy as a whole is not looking super hot right now.
Well, the sky's
falling. Yeah, I mean, the companies are all laying people off, and everybody's bracing for the worst. You know, IT spending is going to go down, and you know, and whenever that starts to happen, you know, everybody's belt tightens, and you know, I think you're going to have a lot of companies that, you know, one, can't get funding anymore, and then they can't generate enough revenue to keep going and keep the lights on, and they're just going to slowly slip away into the darkness. And Panassus may be very one of them. And then somebody's going to come along that's got a big checkbook, and they're going to start picking up IP for pennies on the dollar.
Well, I think that's likely what's going to happen there.
Circle of life.
I think it's likely what's going to happen there. I mean, a lot of big players, you know, cloud players already have object storage technology, right? Amazon doesn't need it. You know, the reason for Amazon or Microsoft or Google buying them is so other people won't get it.
Yeah, right? I don't think they need to do that.
No, I don't think they do either. I mean, Amazon doesn't play that way. Amazon just says, we'll sell our stuff cheaper than you, so it doesn't matter what you have. But somebody's got
the EMC said that they're less expensive than S3.
Yeah, right.
By 65%.
Yeah, that's a believable thing. Yeah.
I do need to go back and reread that entire thing and take a little more deeper notes, because I did have questions, right? I'm like, on his face, it did not resonate well with me. I'm like, yeah.
Packet Pushers had a whole thing on that, and there were a lot of caveats to how it was cheaper.
In this one particular instance, for this one customer, when the moon's aligned with Jupiter, it was that.
Hey, so Gabriel, you are exempt from this following discussion. This is for Lauren and me, and we're going to close out the show with this.
Great.
I don't know about you, Lauren, but I noticed when Gabe came on that Rick left. are these the same guys?
I thought you were going to ask that.
Yeah, I'm asking that. Are these?
We go back to our superhero theme here, where is Rick and Gabe? You know, is Rick the Superman to Gabe's Clark Cable, Clark Kent?
Lauren, are you still adding to your beer count?
Clark Gable.
You know who? Clark Kent.
Clark Gable Kent.
You know, I would have messed that up.
Yeah, I can't pull that mustache off anyway.
Yeah, but Clark Gable are you Rickatron? So. That's what we want to know. Are you the Rickatron? Are you the same guy?
No, because there are pictures you came and of us went together.
I mean, but since you've come on, have we heard you and Rick the same thing, man?
Yeah, you did. We were on together. There are pictures of us together in the same room.
Yeah, but you know, you can do things with Photoshop. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it might be video.
Twin sons of different mothers, doppelgangers, audio doppelgangers. Thanks everybody for listening. This was In Tech We Trust. What was the episode 72?
Yep.
Good.
Stick a fork in it.